Everybody keeps asking if I'm okay. But what do you say when you've been drowning so long? You don't even remember what breathing feels like anymore. I've been fighting my mind every night alone, trying to survive in a place that don't feel like home. People see my face, but they don't know how close I've been to emotionally letting go. I smile so nobody notices pain, but inside my thoughts been going insane. Every memory still leaves stains, and every heartbreak still remains. I gave love to people who disappeared, gave trust and got betrayal for years. Now every conversation feels weird, because attachment became connected to fear. And honestly, I'm exhausted deeply, tired of pretending life don't defeat me. Tired of carrying trauma secretly, while everybody keeps expecting strength from me. I got nights where silence gets dangerous. That's when depression starts changing us, turning overthinking into self-destruction, till breathing itself feels painful enough. I can't save myself, no matter how hard I try. These thoughts keep pulling me under, while I'm screaming silently inside, yeah. I'm losing this war with my mind, trying to survive one night at a time. And honestly, the hardest part is nobody seeing the pain I hide. Yeah. I remember nights sitting on my bedroom floor, asking God what I'm suffering for. Why every year hurts more and peace keeps walking out the door. I grew up believing pain was normal, that silence was safer than being emotional. So I buried feelings deep internally till depression started controlling me. Now my mind never rests peacefully, every thought attacks repeatedly, turning small problems into tragedies and happiness into uncertainty. People say just stay positive casually, like trauma disappears magically, but scars don't heal instantly, especially when they cut emotionally. And maybe that's why I turn to music, because speaking pain feels therapeutic. Maybe broken souls use lyrics to survive things too painful to deal with. I can't save myself, no matter. Sometimes I wonder if people would care if one day I disappear from here. Would they finally?
Ernest Presley. Inside a parking lot near 7400 Malvern Avenue in Philadelphia, a man was shot and killed on the morning of September 1st, 2018. When police arrived, it looked like another homicide scene in a city already burdened by violence. There was no immediate public indication that this killing would later connect to a broader federal prosecution. At that point, it was one location, one victim, later identified as Sean Small, and the beginning of a homicide investigation. Detectives canvassed the area and collected surveillance footage. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, video later captured Ernest Presley near the scene of Small's murder. Additional footage placed Presley at a Philadelphia bar with Small and other men the evening before the killing. That connection became critical. On September 7th, 2018, Presley was arrested in connection with Small's murder. At the time of his arrest, the case appeared to center on a single homicide. But it did not remain that way. As investigators reviewed additional evidence, they began looking backward. The name, Ernest Presley, did not stop at September 2018. Other killings previously investigated separately began to reappear under scrutiny. On January 13, 2017, Kion Fruster had been leaving his home and entering a tow truck driven by a co-worker when he was approached and shot. Fruster was killed. His co-worker was also shot, but survived. According to federal prosecutors, Presley had agreed to kill Fruster in exchange for money to prevent him from testifying as a witness in an assault trial. That allegation reframed the killing as murder for hire rather than spontaneous violence. The day before Fruster's killing, on January 12, 2017, Eric Robinson, a tow truck worker for A. Bob's Towing, had been shot and killed near 4500 Melrose Street as he left work. Federal prosecutors later stated that Robinson had been selected at random from among Fruster's co-workers. According to the government's account, Robinson's killing had been intended to misdirect investigators and make the violence appear related to a tow truck dispute rather than a targeted effort to silence a witness. One day earlier, on January 11, 2017, Maurice Riley had been working on his vehicle at a garage near East Sharpnack and Baldwin Streets in East Mount Airy when he was also shot and killed. Prosecutors later identified Presley as responsible for Riley's murder as well. At the time Riley was killed, it had not publicly been linked to the other shootings. That connection was established later as the federal case developed. The timeline extended further back to the year before. On July 19, 2016, Clarence Young had been sitting on the porch of a residence near the 1500 block of West Olney Avenue when he was shot. He died the following day, July 20, 2016. And according to the Department of Justice, Presley later admitted that he had shot and killed Young. That admission became part of the federal record. The violence still did not stop there. On July 24, 2018, Yasir Hopkins was killed near 56th Street and Ethan Street. Federal prosecutor stated that Presley admitted providing the location of a man he knew was wanted dead by a Philadelphia drug trafficker and that Hopkins was killed in a case of mistaken identity. The mistaken identity detail was included in the government's official description of the case. There was also the attempted murder that survived. On July 9, 2018, a woman had arrived home on North Woodstock Street when she was shot. She survived the attack. Later, she discovered her home had been ransacked and items stolen. Before we move on, kindly support my channel by liking the authorities. Presley was identified several hours later selling her Rolex watch at a Philadelphia pawn shop. That sequence became part of the evidentiary trail. As the investigation expanded, federal authorities described a broader structure. Presley had used a cellular phone to communicate with a co-conspirator to plan how and when murders would be committed. The charges included conspiracy to commit murder for hire and multiple counts of using interstate commerce facilities in the commission of murder for hire. The use of communication technology to coordinate the killings brought the case into federal jurisdiction. On September 21, 2022, Ernest Presley pleaded guilty in federal court. The plea covered the murders of Clarence Young, Maurice Riley, Eric Robinson, Kyan Fruster, Sean Small, and Yasir Hopkins, as well as the attempted murder of the woman on North Woodstock Street. Months later, on May 16, 2023, U.S. District Judge Eduardo C. Robreño sentenced Presley to 5 consecutive life sentences in federal prison, ensuring permanent incarceration. In announcing the sentence, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania described the case as a prime example of why the Department of Justice prioritized tackling violent crime. The FBI's Philadelphia Division referred to the prosecution as a case in point, emphasizing that violent crime could be driven by a smaller group of chronic offenders and highlighting coordination between federal and local law enforcement. When the full record was assembled in court, it showed 6 murdered victims and 1 surviving attempted murder victim. What had first appeared in September 2018 as a single homicide investigation had ultimately become a consolidated federal case spanning killings from 2016 through 2018, linked by money, communication, and coordinated intent. Linda Weston with Gregory Thomas, Gene McIntosh, and Eddie Wright. In October 2011, a landlord in the Tacony section of Northeast Philadelphia went to check on a property he owned. When he accessed the basement area, what he saw led to police being called. Officers arrived and discovered several adults with intellectual disabilities confined in a basement space. That moment became the public beginning of a case that federal prosecutors would later describe as a long-running racketeering enterprise built around the exploitation of vulnerable adults. The woman at the center of the case was Linda Ann Weston. Federal authorities later identified three co-defendants connected to the same enterprise: her daughter Jean McIntosh, Gregory Thomas, and Eddie Wright. When a federal indictment was unsealed in January 2013, prosecutors alleged that the group had targeted adults with intellectual disabilities over a period that stretched back years, moving them across multiple states and maintaining control through intimidation, isolation, and physical abuse. In the days that followed the basement discovery, local reporting identified one of the victims as Weston's niece, Beatrice Weston. The charges in the case included racketeering conspiracy, forced labor, involuntary servitude, fraud involving Social Security benefits, and hate crimes based on disability. The Department of Justice stated that the victims were targeted specifically because of their mental disabilities. According to the federal charging document summarized by the Department of Justice and the FBI Philadelphia field office, the enterprise confined victims in locked basements, attics, and closets. Prosecutors alleged that the group assumed control over the victims' disability benefits and Social Security payments and diverted those funds for their own use. The conduct was not framed as isolated abuse. It was charged under federal racketeering statutes, meaning prosecutors alleged an organized, coordinated criminal enterprise operating across state lines. The indictment also included a charge that elevated the gravity of the case beyond confinement and financial exploitation. Weston was charged with kidnapping, resulting in death. Federal authorities later confirmed that this charge was connected to the death of a victim within the broader enterprise. In September 2015, Linda Weston pleaded guilty to all federal charges against her. According to the Department of Justice, her guilty plea included racketeering conspiracy, kidnapping resulting in death, forced labor, hate crime offenses based on disability, fraud charges tied to government benefits, and related counts. The plea resolved the federal case against her without trial. On November 5, 2015, United States District Judge Cynthia M. Roof sentenced Weston to life imprisonment plus 80 years in federal prison. The Department of Justice publicly confirmed the sentence, describing it as life plus 80 years for her leadership role in the racketeering enterprise that exploited and abused disabled adults. The case did not end with Weston's sentencing. In August 2018, Jean McIntosh was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania described her as a participant in the decade-long racketeering enterprise led by Weston. In September 2018, Eddie Wright was sentenced to 27 years in federal prison for his role in the same scheme. Gregory Thomas was also charged as part of the racketeering enterprise outlined in the federal indictment. Beatrice Weston filed a civil lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia. Reporting on that suit raised questions about how child welfare and adult protection systems could fail to detect or prevent prolonged abuse when warning signs existed. The case became widely cited in discussions about oversight gaps involving adults with intellectual disabilities. The fact that the enterprise had allegedly controlled victims' Social Security benefits contributed to broader scrutiny of representative payee monitoring and financial exploitation protections. Yvonne Hiller. The Kraft Foods plant on the 12,000 block of Roosevelt Boulevard in Northeast Philadelphia was operating the way it always had. Workers were moving through their shifts, supervisors were on the floor, and machines were running. It was just another evening on September 9th, 2010, inside a facility where people had spent years earning a paycheck. Yvonne Hiller had been one of those employees, and reports at the time described ongoing tension between her and certain co-workers, arguments that had built up over time. That night, shortly after 8:30 p.m., another dispute unfolded. Management stepped in and made a decision to suspend her. Then security escorted her out of the building. For everyone still inside, it likely felt like the conflict had ended there, and work continued. But outside in the parking lot, the story did not end. Police later said that after being escorted out, Hiller went to her vehicle and made phone calls. One of those calls was to her boyfriend, who became concerned enough to contact authorities, warning that she had had enough. That warning went out before any shots were fired. Inside the plant, however, the shift continued as normal. 47-year-old Tanya Wilson remained at her station. 36-year-old LaTanya Brown also continued working. Bryant Dalton was still on duty, and no alarms had been triggered. No evacuation had been ordered. Then Hiller made another decision. According to reporting, she retrieved a .357 Magnum handgun from her vehicle. She was licensed to carry the weapon. Armed, she returned toward the entrance of the plant she had just been removed from. Accounts in the media described her forcing her way back in. One report stated that she pointed the gun at a guard to gain entry. Another described her driving her vehicle into a fence before making her way inside. What remained consistent was that she re-entered the building with a firearm. Inside, there had been no lockdown procedure in place to stop her return. Workers were still moving between stations. And then, all of a sudden, the gunfire started. Tanya Wilson was struck. LaTanya Brown was struck. Bryant Dalton was shot as well, but he survived. In a matter of moments, a workplace argument had escalated into a double homicide. Emergency crews responded. Police secured the scene. Wilson and Brown were pronounced dead. While Dalton was transported for treatment and survived his injuries, Hiller left the plant after the shooting before police arrived. Law enforcement began searching for her immediately, and according to reports, she was arrested roughly an hour later. The .357 Magnum was recovered. She was taken into custody and charged with two counts of first-degree murder, attempted murder for the shooting of Dalton, and related offenses. The criminal case moved forward over the next 2 years. In September 2012, Hiller faced a bench trial rather than a jury trial. The court reviewed the sequence of events, the suspension, the retrieval of the firearm, the return to the plant, and the shootings. Under Pennsylvania law, a conviction for first-degree murder carries a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. After hearing the evidence, the judge found her guilty on two counts of first-degree murder and additional charges connected to the attempted killing of Bryant Dalton. The sentence was imposed. Life without parole. Coverage of the sentencing noted the wait inside the courtroom. The judge publicly questioned how Hiller had been able to obtain a license to carry a firearm. Family members of the victims addressed the court. For them, the legal conclusion did not change the outcome of that night, but it formalized accountability. In 2015, a Philadelphia jury returned a civil verdict, awarding more than $38 million to the families of Tanya Wilson and LaTanya Brown. The lawsuit centered on claims of negligence related to workplace security and access control. That civil judgment pushed the case beyond criminal responsibility and into corporate liability. It became part of broader discussions about how companies respond when an employee is suspended or terminated, and what measures must be in place to prevent re-entry during a volatile situation. Security industry publications later referenced the shooting when examining workplace violence prevention and liability exposure. Elias Diaz. On a warm afternoon in July 2003, a 30-year-old woman laced up her shoes and went for a run in Fairmount Park in Philadelphia. Her name was Rebecca Park. She was a fourth-year student at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, originally from Olney, Maryland, and she was weeks away from finishing medical school. She left to exercise in one of the largest urban park systems in the country. But sadly, she never came home. Hours passed, then days. Search efforts moved through the park's wooded slopes. Eventually, police found her body. Authorities said she had been strangled. Her body was discovered buried beneath wood and leaves on a steep hillside, roughly 200 feet off the road inside Fairmount Park. Investigators treated it as a sexual assault and homicide from the beginning. For Rebecca Park's family, the timeline froze in 2003. For detectives, the case did not. In the months surrounding her killing, police were already investigating other violent attacks inside the city's park system. In April 2003, a 21-year-old jogger was raped in Fairmount Park. In October 2003, a 37-year-old woman fought off an attacker during an attempted rape in the same park. Years later, in 2007, a 29-year-old woman walking in Pennypack Park was sexually assaulted and robbed. Investigators believed the cases were connected, but belief is not proof, and proof requires a name. They had DNA, but what they did not have was a confirmed suspect. The evidence remained in storage while technology changed. Years passed, and detectives revisited the file. According to reporting from WHYY, the Associated Press, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, Sir, the turning point came through advances in DNA analysis and investigative genetic genealogy. By 2021, 18 years after Rebecca Park was killed, police were now using modern forensic tools to generate composite sketches and to pursue genealogical database comparisons. The investigation reportedly involved collaboration with Parabon Nanolabs, a company known for forensic genealogy work. Detectives were not just searching for one person. They were building out family trees, reportedly working through a network of nearly 1,000 individuals connected through genetic data as they narrowed down potential relatives. The name that emerged from that work was Elias Diaz. At that time, however, police did not yet have a direct DNA sample from him that tied him conclusively to the 2003 homicide. Then, in December 2023, something shifted. Sir, Philadelphia police began receiving reports of violent attacks in Pennypack Park. According to reporting, a man riding a bicycle allegedly approached people on the trail and attacked them with a large blade. On December 17, 2023, officers arrested Elias Diaz, then 46 years old, in connection with those Pennypack incidents. Once Diaz was in custody, investigators obtained his DNA. When that DNA was compared to evidence preserved from the 2003 Fairmount Park cases, authorities reported a direct match. The DNA tied him not only to the April 2003 sexual assault, but also to the homicide of Rebecca Park. On December 20th, 2023, Diaz was arraigned on charges including murder and rape in connection with the 2003 killing of Rebecca Park. He was ordered held without bail, pending a preliminary hearing. Additional charges were later filed tying him to other cold case assaults from 2003 and 2007, including counts such as rape, attempted kidnapping, aggravated assault, and related offenses. There has been no sentencing yet. The case is still in the charging and pretrial phase. But something else had already happened. Rebecca Park's case became part of a broader national conversation about DNA technology and investigative genetic genealogy. The reporting did not frame it as a local story alone. It placed the case alongside a growing number of cold cases reopened years, sometimes decades, later through consumer DNA databases and forensic genealogy analysis. The Philadelphia Inquirer specifically described how genealogy databases were used to identify relatives and build family trees in order to narrow down a suspect. That process, once rare, is now part of modern law enforcement strategy in certain cold cases. 20 years after a medical student went for a run, preserved biological evidence and evolving science brought her case back into a courtroom calendar. And the question is whether DNA, preserved in 2003 and interpreted through 2020's technology, will hold up under the full scrutiny of trial. Amin Hurst and Nasir Grant. On May 7th, 2023, it was Sunday night at the Philadelphia Industrial Correctional Center, PICC, part of the Philadelphia Department of Prisons complex along State Road in Northeast Philadelphia. Recreation time was underway. The perimeter fencing separated inmates from the outside world. At approximately 8:30 p.m., Amin Hurst, 18 years old at the time, and Nasir Grant, 24 years old, were inside that recreation yard. Hearst was awaiting trial on multiple homicide charges tied to separate fatal shootings in Philadelphia, while Grant was being held on drug and gun-related charges, according to reporting by the Philadelphia Inquirer. Somewhere along the fence line, a breach was made. According to the City of Philadelphia's official statement, the two men cut a hole in the recreation yard fence. So they passed through it, and they exited the secured perimeter. No public alarm was issued that night. The facility continued operating. It was not until the following afternoon, on Monday, May 8th, that staff determined Hearst and Grant were missing. The City of Philadelphia later confirmed that police were notified shortly after 3 p.m. Nearly 19 hours had passed since the escape. That delay became a central fact as the story spread beyond Philadelphia. Outside the jail walls, the search began. But before then, the charges that had placed Hearst inside PICC began years earlier and needs to be noted. On December 24th, 2020, in the Overbrook section of Philadelphia, 20-year-old Daiwoo Scruggs was walking to catch a bus to work when he was shot and killed. Prosecutors later identified Amin Hearst as responsible. Less than a year later, again in Overbrook, gunfire erupted. Four young men were shot. Naquan Smith, 24, was killed. Tamir Brown, 17, was killed. Two others were wounded and survived. Prosecutors charged Hearst in that attack. About a week after that shooting, another killing took place outside the Curran Frumhold Correctional Facility. 20-year-old Rodney Hargrove was shot outside the jail and then struck by a vehicle. Reporting at the time indicated investigators believed the shooting involved mistaken identity. The Philadelphia District Attorney later included Hargrove among the four homicide victims tied to Hearst's case. By May 2023, Hearst was awaiting trial on those charges. The District Attorney's office later confirmed the case involved four counts of third-degree murder, two counts of attempted murder, robbery charges, firearms offenses, and, after May 7th, escape and conspiracy to escape. Back at PICC on May 7th, the mechanics of the escape were straightforward, a cut fence. What followed was scrutiny. After staff realized the men were missing on May 8th, facilities were placed on lockdown, warrants were issued. The Department of Prisons Compliance Office began reviewing security footage. Staff assignments were examined. Phone calls made prior to the escape were reviewed. Staff and inmates were interviewed. The mayor's office coordinated with state officials for a vulnerability assessment of the facility. Associated press reporting highlighted broader concerns. Coverage described perimeter vulnerabilities and staffing issues. Follow-up reporting referenced allegations that motion detection systems were not functioning and that weaknesses in fencing had previously been identified. The delay in detection became part of the national narrative. Law enforcement agencies coordinated across jurisdictions. The public was asked for tips. And while the search was ongoing, Nasir Grant was captured 4 days after the escape. But Amin Hearst remained at large longer. On May 17th, 2023, 10 days after the breach, Hearst was captured and taken back into custody. The manhunt ended, but the scrutiny did not. Associated Press coverage circulated nationally. The escape was described as exposing weaknesses in perimeter fencing, surveillance gaps, and staffing shortages in a major urban jail system. What began as a local breach became a national example of jail security failures. The incident prompted investigations, policy reviews, and renewed scrutiny of correctional oversight practices in large city jail systems across the country. The criminal cases moved forward. On November 1, 2024, Amin Hearst entered a guilty plea resolving the homicide charges and related offenses, including escape. On November 14, 2024, Judge J. Scott O'Keefe sentenced him to 55 to 110 years in state prison. The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office confirmed the sentence and listed the convictions. Four third-degree murders, two counts of attempted murder, robberies, firearms offenses, escape, and conspiracy to escape. The documented sequence stood in full. four homicide victims, Dayewu Scruggs, Naquan Smith, Tamir Brown, and Rodney Hargrove. A fence cut at PICC, nearly 19 hours before detection. Grant was captured after 4 days, and Hurst was captured after 10. A 55 to 110-year sentence, and a documented national effect, internal investigations, public scrutiny, and policy review concerning perimeter security, surveillance gaps, and staffing in large urban jail systems. All grounded in the official city release, Associated Press reporting, and the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office record. Margarita Garabito. In October 2009, inside a row house on the 4700 block of C Street in Feltonville, a 10-year-old girl named Charlene Ferreira was living in a home that, by that point, had already raised concern years earlier. That concern had been documented, it had been written down, and it had been reported, but it had not stopped what was coming. On October 22, 2009, Philadelphia police announced charges against two adults in that home. Charlene's stepmother, Margarita Garabito, and her father, Domingo Ferreira. Both were charged in connection with the child's death. Authorities described the case as one involving prolonged abuse that ended fatally. A municipal court judge later used language that made the city pause, describing the child as having been tortured and saying that many people had failed her. Those words did not come at sentencing. They came early during the initial stages of court proceedings as the judge held Garabito for trial. But the story did not begin in October 2009. It reaches back to October 2006. 3 years earlier, school nurses had noticed bruises and recurring injuries on Charlene. According to testimony later reported by the Philadelphia Inquirer, those nurses were alarmed enough to file a report with the city's child welfare system. The injuries were not subtle and they were not noticeable. They were visible enough to trigger a formal concern. That detail became critical later, because it established that warning signs existed well before the fatal week in 2009. Now back in October 2009, Charlene was 10 years old. She was inside the home with her stepmother, Margarita Garabito, and her father, Domingo Ferreira. During that week, the physical abuse inflicted on Charlene intensified. The injuries she sustained became catastrophic. Emergency responders were eventually called to the home, but despite medical intervention, Charlene Ferreira was pronounced dead. Within days, on October 22nd and 23rd, Philadelphia police publicly identified the residents on C Street and announced that both Margarita Garabito and Domingo Ferreira would be charged in connection with her death. Authorities were treating the case as homicide. Investigators also explored the possibility of sexual assault. That possibility was examined, but preliminary DNA testing did not produce evidence sufficient to support sexual assault charges. Authorities separated suspicion from proof, and that distinction remained part of the record. Then something happened that permanently altered the trajectory of accountability in the case. Domingo Ferreira was admitted to the Curran Fromhold Correctional Facility in Philadelphia. He was placed in intake and quarantine housing. 3 days later, on October 25, 2009, he was found dead inside his cell. Authorities stated he had hanged himself, and the death was reported as a suicide. During intake 3 days earlier, he was evaluated and was not deemed suicidal. The case against him never proceeded to full adjudication, as trial never took place, and there was no sentencing. From that point forward, the prosecution narrowed to Margarita Garabito. The case moved slowly through the system. Years passed. The prior nurse reports from 2006 resurfaced during trial testimony. Jurors heard that concerns had been raised long before the fatal week. They heard about patterns of injury, they heard about the home environment, and they were asked to determine intent. On February 20th, 2015, a Philadelphia jury convicted Margarita Garabito of first-degree murder. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Appellate records later confirmed that she also received an additional consecutive sentence of 22.5 to 45 years on related offenses. The effect of the case was not legislative reform tied to a single statute. It was something quieter but persistent. The case became part of Philadelphia's recurring reference point when fatal child abuse cases arose and questions surfaced about whether prior signs had been missed. The question that lingered was about October 2006, when injuries were noticed, recorded, and reported, and what had to happen systemically for documented warning signs to become decisive intervention before a case ever reached a courtroom. Joshua Huppertürz. In late August 2017, the fall semester had just begun at Temple University in North Philadelphia. Students were moving back into off-campus apartments along North Broad Street. Bars near Cecil B. Moore Avenue were busy with the usual start-of-term crowd. It was the kind of week that felt regular: new classes, familiar nightlife, crowded sidewalks after midnight. On the night of August 30th, 2017, 22-year-old Jenna Burley went out with friends to Pub Web, a bar located just steps from Temple's campus. Jenna was a Temple junior majoring in film and media arts. She was from Harleysville, Pennsylvania. Friends and family later described her as creative and compassionate. And that night, nothing about her plan stood out as unusual. Shortly before 2 a.m. on August the 31st, 2017, surveillance footage showed Jenna still inside Pub Web. Around closing time, she left the bar with Joshua Huppertürz, a former Temple student who was in his late 20s. The two walked together to his apartment on the 1700 block of North 16th Street, a short distance from campus housing. What happened inside that apartment became the central issue at trial. According to prosecutors, sexual activity occurred, and at some point it became violent. The medical examiner later ruled Jenna Burley's death a homicide, citing blunt force trauma and strangulation. She did not leave the apartment alive. In the hours that followed, investigators later alleged that Huppertürz placed Jenna's body into a plastic storage container. He transported it first to his mother's garage in Jenkintown, Montgomery County. Then, later, he moved the body again, this time to his grandmother's property in the Pocono Mountains region in Monroe County. One of the details that quickly drew widespread attention was how part of that transport occurred. Early reporting revealed that a lift ride had been used during the movement of the body. That fact pulled digital evidence into the center of the case, as the rideshare record became part of the timeline. Meanwhile, Jenna had been reported missing, after friends and family could not reach her. Investigators began retracing her last known movements. Surveillance footage confirmed she left Pub Web with Huppertürz. Phone records and location data narrowed the timeline, and detectives identified him as the last person seen with her. According to reporting from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Huppertürz was located at Pennsylvania State Police Barracks and taken into custody before Jenna's body was discovered. Soon after, state police located her remains on the Monroe County property. He was immediately charged with first-degree murder, abuse of a corpse, tampering with evidence, and possession of an instrument of crime. The trial began in January 2019. During proceedings, Huppertürz pleaded guilty to abuse of a corpse but contested the murder charge. His defense argued that his roommate had committed the killing, but prosecutors presented surveillance footage, digital data, and evidence of the movement and concealment of the body. Reporting described the evidence as extensive. After deliberation, the jury convicted Joshua Huppertürz of first-degree murder. At sentencing, Judge Glenn Bronson imposed the mandatory sentence for first-degree murder in Pennsylvania: life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Additional consecutive time was imposed for abuse of a corpse, tampering with evidence, and possession of an instrument of crime. According to courtroom reporting by the Temple News and local outlets, Judge Bronson described the crime as outrageous and terrible. Jenna's family delivered victim impact statements. They spoke about who she was beyond the crime: a daughter, a student, a young woman whose bright future had been cut short. Their statements focused on loss and the permanent absence created by that night. After the criminal case concluded, the Burley family filed a wrongful death and negligence lawsuit against Pub Webb, alleging that excessive alcohol service contributed to the events of that evening. The civil case added another layer to the public conversation surrounding the tragedy. At the same time, Jenna's memory became attached to advocacy work. Jenna's blessing bags, created in her honor, began distributing care packages to individuals experiencing homelessness, keeping her name present in the community in a different way. The broader impact of the case extended beyond Philadelphia. National reporting repeatedly referenced the role of Lyft records and digital tracking in reconstructing the timeline. Law enforcement officials and media commentators pointed to the case as an example of how digital footprints, rideshare logs, phone location data, surveillance cameras can rapidly narrow an investigation and contradict alternative narratives. The digital evidence did not prevent the crime, but it significantly shaped how it was solved. Keon King. On the night of October 4, 2025, 23-year-old Kata Scott was at work in Philadelphia. It was an ordinary shift. Nothing about the night suggested it would be the last time anyone would see her alive. Sometime after 10 p.m., her phone rang. A co-worker would later tell investigators that Kata looked shaken, her eyes filled with tears, and she appeared frightened. The co-worker remembered her saying something along the lines of, "I can't believe you're calling me." Investigators later testified that digital records showed her device stopped transmitting location data shortly after 10 p.m. By the next morning, she had not come home. At first it was confusion, then concern, then urgency. Family members began searching, calls were made, messages were sent, but Kata Scott was gone. In the weeks before her disappearance, she had told people close to her that she felt she was being harassed. That detail would take on weight later, but on October 4th, it was just something she had confided privately. Investigators would later establish that on October 3rd, just before midnight, a Hyundai Accent had been stolen from the 6600 block of Sprague Street after being left unattended and running. At the time, it was simply a vehicle theft. The next day, October 4th, text messages show Kata Scott communicating with 21-year-old Keon King, a Delaware resident. The messages arranged a meeting that night. One message read, "Call me when you hear." At approximately 10:15 p.m., cell phone data placed both devices in the same area near her workplace. 9 minutes later, her phone went dark. What happened between 10:15 and 10:24 p.m.? Had not been witnessed publicly. No one testified to seeing the exact moment of violence, but in the days that followed, investigators began piecing together movements. At 10:28 p.m., the stolen Hyundai parked at Aubrey Recreation Center. It remained there for more than 2 days. Cell phone data later showed a device belonging to Keon King, traveling between a residence on the 5500 block of Belmer Terrace and the wooded area behind the vacant Ada H. Lewis Middle School in Germantown. Search warrants were executed at the Belmar Terrace residence. Officers recovered contractor bags, a hammer, and ammunition. Two women present at the home were detained, interviewed, and later released. Then surveillance footage added another layer. On the night of October 5th, a Toyota Camry registered to Keon King was captured on camera parking near a recreation center close to the wooded area behind the school. Two individuals exited the vehicle, and several hours later, around 4 a.m., according to investigators, surveillance showed the two removing a large, heavy object and carrying it toward the wooded area. At that point in the timeline, the public still did not know what had happened to Kata Scott. Search efforts expanded. Investigators combed Aubrey Arboretum. They searched near Gypsy Lane condominiums. Family members and community volunteers canvassed the area near the school. Some say they noticed disturbed ground. Some others reported unusual odors. On October 17th, police received what they described as a very specific anonymous tip. The next day, October 18th, officers returned to the wooded area behind the vacant Ada H. Lewis Middle School. In a shallow grave, they found the body of an unidentified woman with a gunshot wound to the head. DNA testing confirmed it was Kata Scott, and the Philadelphia Medical Examiner ruled her death a homicide. Only after the recovery did the legal phase begin to take shape. Keon King surrendered to authorities. He was charged with murder, kidnapping, robbery, abuse of a corpse, tampering with evidence, firearms violations, and related conspiracy offenses. He was initially held on $2.5 million bail on earlier charges, and later, after the murder charge was formally filed, he was held without bail. He is held at the Curran Fromhold Correctional Facility. During a preliminary hearing, investigators testified about the cell phone data, the surveillance footage, the vehicle movements, and the recovery site. After that hearing, a judge ordered that he be held for trial. That trial has not taken place yet. There has been no verdict, and no sentencing for the final judgment. But the impact of the case has carried beyond the charges, as the disappearance unfolded publicly. The search drew community involvement. The allegations, involving an alleged kidnapping and homicide, generated widespread regional and national coverage. And advocacy groups later referenced the case during public hearings examining Philadelphia's response to domestic violence and missing person reports. Sadare Lindsay and Tyrek McWilliams, April 23, 2020, became one of those dates that a family would never forget. In the middle of the afternoon at 65th Street and Dix Avenue in Southwest Philadelphia, a 17-year-old named Taj Williams stepped into what prosecutors would later describe as an ambush. Within months, two names, Sadare Lindsay and Tyrek McWilliams, would be tied to that moment through surveillance footage, forensic evidence, and testimony. And within 2 years, both would stand in a courtroom facing mandatory life sentences. At around 3 p.m., a white SUV pulled up near the corner at Massis Market. 17-year-old Taj Williams stepped out. Two other teenagers, Tyquan Smith and Lamar Richards, climbed out behind him. They were just kids standing on a sidewalk, moving toward the store. Nothing in that moment suggested danger, but across the street, two men were already there. Surveillance footage later shown in court captured them near a parked van, lingering. They weren't passing through, and they weren't shopping. They were waiting. Their names were Sadare Lindsay and Tyrek McWilliams. Taj had turned his back slightly as he headed toward Massis Market. That was when the shooting started. According to the Pennsylvania Superior Court's summary of the trial evidence, Lindsay fired at Taj at close range. At the same time, McWilliams fired towards Smith and Richards as they ran for cover near the SUV. The gunfire was fast and deliberate. When it was over, 17 cartridge casings lay scattered across the pavement, evidence prosecutors used to establish that two guns had been fired during the ambush. The white SUV was later found with multiple bullet holes, and the scene told a clear story that this was not a random chaos, it had been coordinated. An off-duty Philadelphia police officer, Officer Gilbert Brito, happened to be stopped at the red light at that very intersection when he heard the shots. He looked up and saw two armed men moving away. He also saw Taj on the ground. Brito pulled over immediately, called 911, and ran to help. When a marked patrol unit arrived, Brito and another officer lifted Taj into the back of the patrol car so he could be rushed to Penn Presbyterian Medical Center. Despite those efforts, Taj was later pronounced dead. The shooters didn't vanish into thin air. Cameras followed them. The Superior Court opinion described how investigators pulled footage from the city's real-time crime center, along with private security cameras from nearby homes and businesses. The videos traced Lindsay and McWilliams block by block as they fled the scene. At certain points, the footage showed them discarding clothing and other items, shedding pieces of themselves as they tried to disappear. Prosecutors would later present this trail to the jury as proof of consciousness of guilt. Detectives built the case methodically. They collected the 17 casings. They documented the bullet damage to the SUV. They mapped the movements captured on video. The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office later stated that surveillance footage, real-time crime center coordination, and digital content recovered from McWilliams' cell phone further tied both men to the ambush. As the investigation deepened, authorities determined something that added another layer of tragedy. According to the DA's office, the shooting appeared to be a case of mistaken identity. Taj Williams may not have been the intended target, but that conclusion did not lessen the charge. Lindsay was arrested on September 14th in 2020, while McWilliams was arrested roughly a month later. When the case went to trial, the Commonwealth laid out the timeline carefully. Officers testified that they recognized Lindsay and McWilliams from prior familiarity in the neighborhood. One officer said he knew Lindsay well enough to recall his home address from memory. An expert in digital forensics testified about data extracted from McWilliams' phone. The jury watched the surveillance footage. They saw the men near the van. They saw the white SUV arrive. They saw the flight path. The prosecution's theory was clear. The defendants had waited, coordinated, and carried out an ambush. The jury returned guilty verdicts on first-degree murder and conspiracy, along with additional counts including aggravated assault and firearms offenses. On November 28, 2022, before Judge Diana Anhalt, Sadair Lindsay and Tyrek McWilliams were sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. After sentencing, the Philadelphia DA's office publicly emphasized that the verdict was supported by substantial evidence and highlighted the role of community members who assisted law enforcement. Prosecutors pointed to the combination of neighborhood cooperation and modern surveillance technology as central to solving the case. Lindsay later appealed, and in April 2024, the Pennsylvania Superior Court reviewed the record and affirmed the judgment of sentence. The appellate court recounted the surveillance evidence, the cartridge casings, the identification testimony, and the digital forensic recovery. It concluded that the evidence was sufficient to support the convictions. The life without parole sentence stood. The broader effect of the case, as documented in official statements, was not a change in state law or a national reform campaign. Instead, it became an example cited by prosecutors of how integrated surveillance systems and digital evidence could reconstruct a homicide with precision and withstand appellate scrutiny. Marie Scott. In 1973, a robbery in Philadelphia's Germantown section lasted only minutes, but the sentence that followed lasted more than half a century. Marie Mechie Scott was 19 years old when she walked into a neighborhood gas station store with her 16-year-old boyfriend, Leroy Saxton. The reporting that exists about that day is direct and limited in detail, but the facts it confirms are clear. Scott was addicted to heroin. Saxton was armed. Inside the store was 35-year-old Michael Carrigan, a gas station attendant and volunteer firefighter. During the robbery, Carrigan was restrained while money was taken from the register and safe. Before it was over, he was shot in the back of the head, and he died. That single gunshot became the center of everything that followed, even though Scott was not identified in reporting as the person who pulled the trigger. Under Pennsylvania law at the time, and still today, a death that occurs during the commission of a felony can result in a second-degree murder conviction. The sentence for that conviction is mandatory life without parole. Intent to kill does not have to be proven. Participation in the felony is enough. That legal structure shaped Scott's entire future. The coverage does not lay out a minute-by-minute planning sequence. It does not describe who first suggested the robbery or how long they had been preparing. What it does establish is that both were arrested, prosecuted, and convicted. Saxton, later known legally as Benjamin Alston, was identified as the shooter and received life. Scott, convicted under the felony murder rule, also received life without parole. For Kerrigan's family, the loss did not fade with time. Reporting states he left behind a wife and seven children. Decades later, family members would appear at clemency hearings to oppose Scott's release, making clear that for them, the sentence had never felt excessive. Scott entered the Pennsylvania prison system as a teenager and remained there for more than 50 years. She spent time at SCI Muncie. Her prison record was not without incident. Reporting confirms she escaped custody three times between 1975 and 1980, a fact that would later be raised during arguments about whether she should ever be allowed back into society. Time continued to move in complicated ways. While incarcerated, Scott gave birth to a daughter, Hope Seegers. That daughter would grow up visiting her mother in prison, eventually becoming one of the most visible advocates for her release. The story stopped being only about a robbery in 1973. It became about what a life without parole sentence actually looks like over decades. Births, illnesses, aging, all happening behind walls. Outside prison, the legal landscape began to shift. The national conversation around extreme sentencing changed, especially after U.S. Supreme Court rulings limited mandatory life without parole for juveniles. Although Scott was 19 at the time of the crime, technically an adult, her case became entangled in the broader debate about felony murder and permanent incarceration. See, public reporting described her as part of larger constitutional challenges to Pennsylvania's mandatory life without parole structure, and as a symbol in the fight against what advocates call death by incarceration. There was another stark contrast that drew attention. Saxton, the shooter, was eventually released after changes in juvenile life without parole law. Scott remained incarcerated while the younger participant tied directly to the fatal shot left prison years earlier. That contrast became part of why her case was discussed far beyond Philadelphia. By 2025, Scott was 71 years old and seriously ill. Reporting noted a diagnosis of breast cancer and major surgery while still incarcerated. Her legal path forward was no longer through appeal, the conviction stood, but through executive clemency. The clemency process unfolded publicly. In May 2025, the Pennsylvania Board of Pardons voted to recommend commutation of her life sentence. During the hearing, Scott accepted responsibility for her role in the robbery. Members of Kerrigan's family opposed release. One relative was quoted saying, "Cancer is not a get-out-of-jail-free card." On June 16, 2025, Governor Josh Shapiro commuted her sentence. That decision did not free her immediately. It converted her punishment from life without parole to life with the possibility of parole. The door was no longer sealed, but it was not yet open. In December 2025, she was granted parole. And on January 7, 2026, after more than 52 years in custody, Marie Scott walked out of prison. Reporting described her reuniting with her daughter and grandson outside the facility, an image that stood in sharp contrast to the photograph of a 19-year-old entering prison in the early 1970s. Scott's case continues to be cited in discussions about felony murder, mandatory life without parole, and whether accomplices who did not pull the trigger should face permanent imprisonment. Pennsylvania remains one of the states where felony murder still carries mandatory life without parole, a fact that keeps cases like hers in the national legal conversation.
Everybody keeps asking if I'm okay, but what do you say when you've been drowning so long? You don't even remember what breathing feels like anymore. I've been fighting my mind every night alone, trying to survive in a place that don't feel like home. People see my face, but they don't know how close I've been to emotionally letting go. I smile so nobody notices pain, but inside my thoughts been going insane. Every memory still leaves stains, and every heartbreak still remains. I gave love to people who disappeared, gave trust and got betrayal for years. Now every conversation feels weird, because attachment became connected to fear. And honestly, I'm exhausted deeply, tired of pretending life don't defeat me, tired of carrying trauma secretly, while everybody keeps expecting strength from me.
I got nights when silence gets dangerous. That's when depression starts changing us. Turning overthinking into self-destruction till breathing itself feels painful enough. I can't save myself, no matter. Survive one night at a time. And honestly, the hardest part is nobody seeing the pain I hide. Yeah. I remember nights sitting on my bedroom floor, asking God what I'm suffering for. Why every year hurts more and peace keeps walking out the door. I grew up believing pain was normal, that silence was safer than being emotional. So I buried feelings deep internally till depression started controlling me. Now my mind never rests peacefully, every thought attacks repeatedly, turning small problems into tragedies and happiness into uncertainty. People say just stay positive casually, like trauma disappears magically, but scars don't heal instantly, especially when they cut emotionally. And maybe that's why I turn to music, because speaking pain feels therapeutic. Maybe broken souls use lyrics to survive things too painful to deal with. I can't save myself, no matter. Pain I hide. Sometimes I wonder if people would care if one day I disappear from here. Would they finally